The first thing I'm going to do is admit to you that I tried to get out of this ceremony 17 years ago when I was graduating myself. Because I was 22 and I was way too cool to put on a goofy Batman outfit and a paper plate on my head and march down to East College and listen to a bunch of boring geriatrics tell me how it was up to the youth of America to save the world. And so here I am now in a Batman outfit for the first time on any stage, and so I guess the one sure thing I can tell you about DePauw is that sooner or later they get you where they want you. I also have to admit to you that 17 years ago, if someone had suggested to me that one day I'd be on this podium giving the DePauw University commencement address, I would have clasped my sides and hooted and fallen down laughing for several reasons. First, I did not think of myself as a potential geriatric. Second, I was a hardworking student, but I never stood out, I don't think, in anyone's mind as most likely to be some big old whiz-bang success. I was very shy in classes. I almost never spoke up. DePauw was an unfathomably new world to me when I came here, and it stayed that way. I was daunted by it. I had come here from a poor high school in Nicholas County, Kentucky, and when I got here, I found that Midwesterners spoke correctly, and I didn't. People that I didn't know would stop me on the sidewalk and ask me to pronounce words like sky and hair and all, and I began to suspect that I was not going to fit in at DePauw. All I had to do was open my mouth to become a local curiosity. And on top of that, most of the time I wore an army surplus coat that came down to my feet and a green pith helmet, which I had purchased downtown at the army surplus store in an attempt to cope with something else that was new to me. That was the fine Greencastle climate, which you've been here long enough now to know that between the months of November and April, this is an institute of higher learning that doubles as a car wash. So there I was, or here I was, in my pith helmet, working pretty hard. I wasn't much of a party girl. I would have liked to have been, but most of the time I had to study or I had to go to work. I had a job at the print shop downtown, Putnam Printing, and I cleaned houses. And I discovered also that I could make $5 an hour, which was good money for those days, working for the art department. And all I had to do was take off my clothes and sit still for an hour at a time. And once in a while, paintings of me would go on display in the gallery they had in the admin building. So that got me noticed, too. The real reason, though, that I never imagined I would be standing here in these circumstances and doing it happily is that there were some things about my experience at DePauw that were very painful. And at that time, I was short-sighted enough to think that I wouldn't ever want to come back here for any reason. I grew up in a county that didn't have a swimming pool to its name, or a tennis court, or a golf course. And the main entertainment options for young people were the things that you could do in the front seat or in the back seat of a car. I had never heard, for example, of fraternities or sororities. And I was very surprised the first week I arrived here to find everybody energetically discussing something called Rush. I didn't know what that was. As nearly as I could figure, Rush meant going really fast to a bunch of parties where girls would scrutinize me and decide whether or not I would be allowed to join their club. And I didn't think that sounded like very much fun. And I didn't think I had the resources to be involved in that kind of life when I really was realistic about it. So I figured I'd stay home that week, and I'd make curtains for my dorm room, and I'd read the freshman English assignment, and that it was probably no big deal one way or the other. I didn't think that many people would be going through with it. Well, imagine my surprise. The week of rush, when in the evenings when the rush parties were announced and people were going, the dorm became very quiet. In fact, quiet doesn't begin to describe it. Lucy Rowland Hall was like one of those movies where, due to a mutant virus or a unfortunate nuclear holocaust, you've become the last remaining human on the face of the earth. And I was stalking around the halls, listening to the echoes of my footsteps, looking for another survivor, and I didn't find one. And I looked in the mirror to see if I had turned into Roddy McDowell in Planet of the Apes, and then I went and made curtains. But I started thinking I'd come to the wrong university. Later on that semester, I discovered something amazing. I read Blackberry Winter, which is the autobiography of Margaret Mead, one of my heroes, and I discovered that she had gone to DePauw for 1 year before transferring to Barnard like a bat out of hell. She wrote in her autobiography about people laughing at her odd New England accent, and she wrote about going to rush parties in this dress that she had designed and made herself to look like a wheat field with poppies blooming in it. I imagine that dress must have been so beautiful, and it must have been just about as out of place as my green pith helmet. At that party, she writes in Blackberry Winter, my correspondent turned her back on me and never spoke to me again. I found the whole evening strangely confusing. I could not know, of course, that everyone had been given the signal that inviting me had been a mistake. I did not get a bid. Margaret Mead wrote about the bitter confusion of being snubbed for reasons she did not consider valid or important, but which stung anyway. She wrote, by the very contrast that it provided, DePauw clarified my picture of the kind of college at which I wanted to be a student, a place where people were intellectually stirred and excited by ideas, where people stayed up all night talking about things that mattered. I assume, in fact, I'm pretty sure that the Greek system has become much more humane and democratic since those days, but 17 years ago, I related wholeheartedly to Margaret Mead. I dreamed of fleeing to some place like Barnard, too. But then I thought about me and my accent and my pith helmet at Barnard. Right. So I realized that there wasn't any place I could go where people were just like me, except back to Nicholas County. And I just left there on purpose because I wanted to get an education. Plus, I'd already bought the raincoat, so I stayed. And it began to dawn on me that learning how to be in a place where I didn't seem to fit in was going to be part of my education. Pretty soon I found people who liked to stay up all night talking about things that mattered. Here, for the first time in my life, I found a community of intellectually stimulating peers who were excited about debating our differences as well as celebrating our similarities. Many of those peers belonged to the clubs that I had not joined. I had to face some of my own prejudices, and I recognized that I had been making unsubstantiated judgments of others just about as extravagantly as they'd been judging me. I learned about a million things here, and only one of them was how to spell potato. I learned you don't wear jeans on a tennis court. I learned that growing up on the south side of Chicago is a whole lot harder in some ways than growing up on the south side of an alfalfa field. I learned that being laughed at is not the end of the world, but that having no sense of humor is the end of the world. I learned that 12 people will fit into a Volkswagen Beetle, but you can't close the doors. I learned that in a pinch, And I would define pinch by male visitation hours are over and the dorm police are coming up the stairs, that upper compartment of the closet in Lucy Rowland will hold a fairly good-sized human being. I learned that the people who are first to speak up in class aren't always the ones who know the most, but it always looks like it. I learned it's possible to go 4 consecutive days without sleep, but that 5 is big trouble. And in the midst of all this learning, sometimes against my will, I received a liberal arts education. I learned how to be a scholar, and I learned that scholarship is not about the information that you can retain in your head. It's about knowing which questions to ask and where to start looking for the answers. I learned that good citizenship means being able to distinguish between appropriate and inappropriate authority. I learned things that would eventually lead me to become a novelist and a thoughtful citizen of the world, even though at the time I didn't plan on being either of those things. The best thing about DePauw is that it required me to take courses in poetry and mathematics and biology and history. I was not allowed to be narrow in my interests, and I was rewarded for trying really hard to see the fibers of logic and consequence that connect poetry and biology and history. I believe that's the most precious and useful kind of education that a person can ever have. And I suspect that the little piece of paper you're about to get today stands for that same kind of education, and I'm glad about that. And I'll tell you why. Because to put it bluntly, the world is going to go to hell in a handbasket if we can't figure out how to see the connections between things. For example, in order to solve a national crisis in healthcare delivery, we have to understand not just pediatrics and surgery and pharmacology, but also things like urban sociology and rural economics and women's studies and law and philosophy and ethics. In order to solve a crisis of national debt and international trade, we have to know not just economics, but also political science and cultural anthropology and how to speak Japanese or Russian or German. And we have to know that we don't live on an island anymore, and the days are gone when we could expect people to swim up speaking our language. The crisis that looms over all the others, I guess, the one that makes the others immaterial if we can't resolve it, the crisis that I think I would resent the most if I were your age now, is the fact that you've inherited an appallingly damaged environment. Your predecessors and me and you, right along with us, have merrily used up the world's resources as if there were no tomorrow, and now, all of a sudden, looks like maybe there won't be a tomorrow. As a species, we'll survive or fail on the basis of our liberal arts education and how we use it, on the basis of how creative we can be and how broadly we can think and how deeply we can believe in the future. It requires a leap of faith, you see. You can tell me that burning gasoline in my car or throwing junk away, using fluorocarbons in my car's air conditioner is going to kill my grandchildren. And I'll say, yeah, right, sure it is. And then I'll go right on doing those things, unless I can get my mind around all the links in that chain. How the CFCs leak out of my car's air conditioner and go up into the atmosphere, and how they react with the ozone up there, and how that allows UV radiation to hit the ocean so hard that it kills the phytoplankton, and how that starts creating famine and universal death in the ocean in just exactly the same way that killing all the wheat and corn on Earth would create universal famine and death on land. And how a dead ocean would be such a big dead link in the global food chain that the rest of us would suffocate and starve. So, okay, I'm going to try really hard to stop using CFCs and throwing away styrofoam, and eventually I hope I can even stop burning gasoline, because I can see the connections between my behavior and the future. I don't know all the links exactly in that chain, inside and out. I don't know the details of the reaction between CFCs and the ozone. I don't know the details of the life history of phytoplankton or the global food chain, but I know just enough chemistry to believe in chemistry. Do you see what I mean? I know enough of poetry to believe the words of Chief Seattle, who asked in a tribal assembly in 1854, "What is man without the beasts? If all the beasts were gone, men would die from a great loneliness of the spirit." I've read that a couple hundred years ago, the Iroquois really had their act together. The Iroquois Federation of Tribes in the northeastern part of North America was a governing body that made all important decisions on the basis of one rule, and that was the seven generations question. That is, they would ask, how does this act we're about to undertake today affect the world seven generations from now? That's a really long time. In modern times in America, we seem inclined to live as if there weren't even going to be a next week, much less a seventh generation. It's interesting that we build structures to last. We build them to meet earthquake codes. But policy, we seem inclined to engineer without any thought for the future. If we did, we would be throwing everything we have into education, into the salvation of wild lands and natural resources, into libraries, into prenatal care, into preventive counseling and life opportunities for kids who are at risk of becoming gun owners later in life. But we don't seem to be doing those things. It's very easy to claim that policy is just such a complicated matter, there's no way to tell what's really the right thing to do. I think that's baloney. I think it's almost always really easy to know what's the right thing to do. If you take the seven generations perspective, it's easy to know which is more important, a pile of paper and lumber and sawdust and buildings that are going to fall down, probably before we do, or a million acres of old growth forest in the Pacific Northwest. There's no question. If you doubt that a single person making a single decision can influence the future, think again, because that's almost all that ever does influence the future. All of history is the accumulation of single decisions. Rosa Parks decided to sit down on that public bus in the section reserved for white people, and she decided not to get up again, even if that meant being spat on and going to jail. And that was only one generation ago, and the world is a whole lot better for it. Rachel Carson decided in 1963 to keep working on her book, Silent Spring, even though she was being ridiculed as a hysterical female. And on top of all that, she was dying of cancer. But she did it anyway. She kept researching and writing, and she published her book, which led to the banning of DDT and the beginning of the environmental movement. And it's only 32 years later now, or something like that. And it's almost impossible to imagine how awful the world would be right now if she hadn't put herself on the line for the sake of the future. I haven't ever had the occasion to be so brave as Rachel Carson or Rosa Parks, but I have to make minor decisions every day in just the same way that you do, and I believe that they could accumulate into something heroic if I keep making decisions in the right direction. I think every day of my life, every time I have a choice between doing this thing or that one, I can think of the future instead of my own convenience. I can vote yes on the school bond election. I can fund the library budget. I can recycle my cans and plastic and styrofoam. I can vote for the person who supports health care rather than the person who supports tax cuts for novelists whose last names start with K. I can get out of the habit of selfishness and start acting like there's going to be a tomorrow. Now, all of you who are sitting out there just this far from being too cool to have a paper plate on your head are thinking, what a jerk. She actually thinks recycling her soda cans is going to keep the world from going to hell in a handbasket. And you're right, I'm a jerk. And you have paper plates on your head, I would add. I blame my liberal arts education. I know just enough about chemistry to believe in the ozone. I know just enough about poetry to believe in the great loneliness of the spirit. And I know just enough about the world to believe in my own position in it. And I think you do too. You're leaving this place with enough knowledge to believe in the connections between your own actions and the rest of the world and the future. You know enough to step outside your chosen domain and listen carefully to people who know things you don't. And you're smart enough to take advice when it's good advice, and to embrace difference rather than exclusivity, and to know that diversity is the thing that can save us. It's entirely up to you, of course, to decide whether it's worth saving us. That's what nobody can decide for you. In the optimism department, though, I think that I have an edge on you because I grew up in the 60s and early 70s, and we had some really useful fashions that gave us an advantage in life. And bell bottoms were not one of them, but optimism was. It was truly fashionable to believe then that you could change the world. My first year of college, I stood right over there by that rock, wherever it is, with several hundred other people, and demonstrated against what we thought was an evil situation being perpetrated against our own soldiers and the people of Vietnam. And the first great thing about that is that we were getting out of class. And the second great thing about that, and the truly amazing thing about that, is that within a year, that war ended. And the soldiers got to come home. And the people of Vietnam got to run their country without benefit of U.S. or French bossiness or napalm being dropped on their heads. And I felt like I got to be a part of that great thing. Of course, that's naive and foolish. You demonstrate against the war ends, you caused the end of the war. That's stupid. That's like when you wash your car and then it rains, you say, awesome, I made it rain. I can take my Trans Am to the Sudan and I can bring relief to drought-stricken Africa. Well, okay, I'll grant you that, but never underestimate the power of a good superstition. I'll tell you the parable of my lucky socks. I had these socks that were hideous. They were given to me by a relative, and they were brown argyle socks, and I never wore them except one day, because of a laundry emergency, I wore them to a music theory exam, and I got a 100 on the exam. And there was no earthly explanation for this except that the socks were lucky. And so after that, I kept wearing them to exams, and my exams had a 4-point average. And of course, if I felt shaky, then after a while I started not wearing the socks to an exam. But most of the time I did. And towards the end there, when it became difficult to care enough to study for any other reason, I studied in order to uphold the grade point average of my socks. And they got me through. So even if my participation in anti-war demonstrations didn't cause the war to end, the important thing is that I believe I helped end that war. And because of that, my life is charmed. I believe in the magic power of resistance. Ever since 1973, any time I see something that looks wrong to me, I skip class and I go holler about it. Because it seems to me that will make a difference. For almost 10 years now, I've been doing most of my hollering through the medium of fiction. I write about things like child abuse and sexism and unfair immigration laws and the evil of a world that lets some people throw money away while other people eat dirt, and the evil and the short-sighted stupidity of treating the natural world like a garbage dump. And I feel like writing these things might make some kind of a difference. I'm not doing it because I expect to see a perfect world in my lifetime. I'm doing it because I want to live a happy life in spite of an imperfect world. So that's how I go about it. I wrote a novel one time about this question of believing you can make a difference. The novel is called Animal Dreams, and in it there are two sisters. One's a cynic, and one's an optimist. The sister who believes in her own power has gone to Nicaragua to try to help make better lives, try to help people there make better lives for themselves. And she writes to her unhappy, cynical sister, trying to explain her course of action. And this is what she says. "I don't expect to see perfection before I die. What keeps you going isn't some fine destination, but just the road you're on and the fact that you know how to drive. You keep your eyes open. You see this damned to hell world you got born into, and you ask yourself, what life can I live that will let me breathe in and out and love somebody or something and not run off screaming into the woods? You're thinking of revolution as a great all or nothing. I think of it as one more morning in a muggy cotton field, checking the undersides of leaves to see what's been there, figuring out what to do that won't clear a path for worse problems next week. Right now, that's what I do. Wars and elections are both too big and too small to matter in the long run. The daily work, that goes on. It adds up. It goes into the ground, into crops, into children's bellies and their bright eyes. Good things don't get lost. Here's what I've decided. The very least you can do in your life is to figure out what you hope for. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. Not admire it from a distance, but live right in it, under its roof. What I want is so simple, I almost can't say it. Elementary kindness. Enough to eat. Enough to go around. The possibility that kids might one day grow up to be neither the destroyers nor the destroyed. That's about it. Right now, I'm living in that hope, running down its hallway and touching the walls on both sides. One of the very few things I've figured out about life since I left here and learned all those things about Volkswagens and dormitory rooms is that it's better to be a hopeful person than a cynical, grumpy one, because you have to live in the same world either way. And if you're hopeful, you have more fun. You get invited to more parties and people like you better and you like yourself better. And hope is a renewable option. If you run out of it at the end of the day, you get to start over in the morning. There's no cost. If you're still with me, you've noticed that I've been here for 20 minutes or more, and I have refrained from acting like I have all the answers, because I don't. I've given you virtually no advice. It's not up to you to save the world. That's the job of every living person who likes the idea of a future. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and give you one little piece of advice, and that is, like the idea of a future. Believe you have it in you to make the world look better rather than worse 7 generations from now. Figure out what that could look like. And then if you're lucky, you'll find a way to live inside that hope, running down its hallways, touching the walls on both sides. Good luck.